I'm Carson Stooley. With me is Fangraphs Managing Editor Dave Cameron, and this is the Pitch Talks Blue Jays Podcast. And this is episode 8 of that same podcast. Do you agree with that? Are you dissenting already?
We've gotten through 7, and we're going to try and get through an 8th.
Yeah, we're going to try and get through an 8th. That's right. That's how this works. Dave Cameron, of course, the Pitch Talks Blue Jays Podcast features us people. You are Dave Cameron, the managing editor of Fangraphs.com. I'm Carson Sestouli, an editor and also of Fangraphs.com and also the host of Fangraphs Audio. And what our mission here is essentially is our patron, Homestand Sports, has commissioned us to provide objective analysis about these Toronto Blue Jays. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I mean, our mission here is to receive money.
Yes, that's true.
That's what we're doing here. And we're doing it in order to provide encouragement for you to attend Pitch Talks events.
Yeah, that's the other commercial part of it. So actually, Dave Cameron, in order to satisfy our patrons, perhaps we should talk briefly about these Pitch Talks events. They are offered by Homestand Sports. Dave Cameron, could you please summarize briefly, what is a Pitch Talk?
It is a gathering of baseball fans in a specific town to spend a few hours talking about their local team and baseball in general, usually attended by various media personalities, writers, announcers. Frequently the general manager of the team can come and say nothing or occasionally be interesting sometimes. And it's usually a rowdy three-hour baseball-filled event.
Right, of adult entertainment, as you have previously stated.
Yeah.
Allow me to inform you, Dave Cameron, about some upcoming Pitch Talks events, the first of which is Monday, June 5th. That's actually just a little less than a week from today. That's a Pitch Talks event in Seattle, including, among others, Kay Prusser, who's written for Fangraphs, writes for Lookout Landing. Ryan Divish, I believe, a capable beat reporter for the Seattle Mariners. Does that sound right?
Yeah, works for the Seattle Times.
Yeah, okay. Meg Rowley, who writes, among other publications, Baseball Prospectus. Jeff Sullivan writes for Fangraphs, and yourself, Dave Cameron.
Yeah, we got a good group. It should be a rowdy time.
Yeah, it should be a rowdy time. Very good. Some other Pitch Talks events. June 8th at the Sport Gallery. June 8th at the Sport Gallery in Toronto. John Thorne. Of course, John Thorne is Major League Baseball's official historian. He will be there on June 8th. That event also begins at 7 p.m., most likely, is what I'm thinking. We have a Pitch Talks event in San Francisco featuring Graham Brisby, for example, who is the owner, operator, editor of McCovey Chronicles. Does that sound right?
That is the name of his blog.
The McCovey Chronicles, right, the SB Nation blog. Grant, of course, wasn't. Eno Saris, whom we know, from Fangraphs.com. And perhaps one of the most anonymous Major League Baseball GMs, Bobby Evans of the San Francisco Giants. Would you say that's fair to say?
Yeah, I went to the San Francisco show last year, and it was probably one of the most fun that we did. It was definitely a rowdy crowd. Mm-hmm. I think I've used the word rowdy 3 times now.
Yeah, you said the word rowdy, which is actually interesting because I'm going to ask you about rowdy Talese.
Oh, yeah. I guess I was just preparing in advance for
That's right.
for the upcoming prospect questions.
Okay, let's stop being cute. That was Monday, June 12th. That's Monday, June 12th, 7:30 p.m., and I will also not neglect to mention that on Thursday, June 15th at 7 p.m., there will be a Pitch Talks event in Pittsburgh, the Club Cafe, June 15th in Pittsburgh, featuring, among others, Travis Sodrick, who writes for Fangraphs.com. And he's a good guy, and Joe Block, one of the play-by-play voices of the Pittsburgh Pirates.
That's right. If you are near any of these cities, you should go. They will be a good time.
Definitely consider it. Okay, Dave Cameron. Now, let us proceed on to some objective analysis. One way we like to start this particular portion of the conversation is to look at the week that has occurred most recently. Of course, we're recording this on Tuesday. Yesterday, Monday, in the United States, we were celebrating Memorial Day. We did not do much work. I suppose we were remembering. We were also probably eating barbecue foods. That's an American custom, of course. Over the last week, though, if we do not include yesterday, if we pretend that the week was only current, the Blue Jays actually only played 4 games, or 5 games, sorry, during that stretch, and they won 3 of them, four and one is the idea.
Right.
4-1, which was vital for a team that really has been on the fringes of competitiveness. However, with this week, and then with the addition of a convincing 17-2 victory over the Cincinnati Reds in the first game of that series in Toronto, according to Fangraphs.com's projections, the Blue Jays are looking at nearly 83 wins, which is not something that would have necessarily seemed likely or probable recently. And they're also looking at projections of making the playoffs of roughly 25%, or at least to win the wild card, and overall about 34%. So that's pretty good.
Yeah, considering where they were for the first 2 weeks of the season, this is a nice little comeback.
This is a nice little comeback. Now, can you please explain to me what has aided the team over the past week?
Well, in April, their struggles were basically all the old players didn't hit. So Russell Martin didn't hit, Troy Tulowitzki didn't hit, Jose Bautista didn't hit. Devin Travis is not old, but he also got caught with not hitting itis. So basically, the guys that they had relied upon to be good hitters, Steve Pierce, didn't hit. The bulk of their lineup, Kendrys Morales, we can basically just name any player on the Blue Jays that was not Josh Donaldson, and they didn't hit, and then Josh Donaldson got hurt, and so they had to be without their best player for 6 weeks, and then things didn't go well in April. But then in May, Jose Bautista has gone right back to being Jose Bautista, and kind of put to rest the questions of whether last year's slow start or last year's kind of poor performance was the beginning of a, you know, total collapse. He might not be as good as he was a few years ago, but he's still a viable major league hitter. Devin Travis has had a monster month. Justin Smoke has hit 8 home runs this month, when I don't know that Justin Smoke hit 8 home runs last year. Basically, everyone who struggled early has caught fire lately, and now Donaldson is back, and Tulowitzki is back, and J.A. Happ is back, so they've weathered the storm, it's gotten some healthy players again, and now they actually look like an offense that can put up 17 runs on you on Memorial Day.
Now, listen, of course, the Blue Jays have had their share of problems this year. However, over the past week, or at least the last 7 days, according to our leaderboards of Fangraphs, they have been second in terms of player position war, behind only the Astros, and of course the Astros have the best record in baseball. Now, they've done it a number of ways. They've recorded an isolated power figure, which essentially slugging percentage minus batting average, over 200. They're one of only three or four teams to have done that. What another thing they've done, and I'm not sure, and I'm interested in your thoughts, is that they have protected against the strikeout quite well. The league average right now is probably, what, 21%, something like that?
22, yeah.
Is it 22%?
Yeah.
Over the last week, the Blue Jays have struck out only 13.4% of the time. And if you include the fact that they have also posted nearly a 9% walk rate, this is one of the sort of narrowest gaps. And I'm curious, does it seem like, no, obviously it's going to, on average, benefit a team as opposed to not benefit a team, but does this seem like a team that was going to thrive, in particular, based on their ability to make contact with the ball?
Yeah, I mean, this has basically been the Blue Jays' model of hitters, but kind of starting with Bautista and Encarnacion 5 years ago, and then look at Donaldson and Tulowitzki. They found or prioritized acquiring guys who hit for power and don't strike out. So, you know, Miguel Sano has tremendous power but strikes out 35% of the time. They don't have any of those kind of guys on their roster. They basically built a lineup full of guys who make solid contact and make a lot of contact. And so this is kind of the thing the Blue Jays were known for. One of the main things that was curious about Jose Bautista in April, he ran a 30% strikeout rate, which is double his career average, and that was one of the things I think that concerned people. Were like, hey, look, if this guy can't even get around on baseball anymore, maybe he is done. But then Bautista has gone right back to not striking out anything for power, and so this is essentially the kind of the hallmark of Blue Jays teams, is they will not swing and miss, and when they make contact, it goes a long way.
Yeah, and it should be said with regard to Jose Bautista, as you mentioned, he was running much higher than average strikeout rates during the month of April. He's actually struck out just less than 20% of the time in May, and of course the month is ends today. And meanwhile, he recorded an ISO figure, again slugging minus average, of 323, which is genuinely elite, and also a figure that is rare to pair with really even a league average strikeout rate. Forget a couple points lower than it.
Yeah, I mean, there's not that many guys in baseball who can, you know, hit for this kind of power and not strike out. The Blue Jays just happen to have a bunch of them.
Right. Now, just one question to revisit Jose Bautista before we move on. We've been citing strikeout rate and this sort of power numbers here. Those tend to be metrics which become stable a little bit more quickly than other ones, right? If a guy puts up a bad batting average for a couple weeks, it's typically not of great concern. It's unfortunate, perhaps, for that team, for their chances to win, to score runs. But it's not necessarily something you look at as being predictive. However, something like strikeout rate and isolated slugging, they tend to become more predictive in smaller samples. And I guess it's surprising that a player like Bautista could turn on a dime, really, by both metrics, between March, the early season there in April, and then May. Do you have any ideas? And I would say that this is maybe added to the fears that he might be quote unquote done. Do you have any sense of what could alter that for a player? I guess besides anything that was of a physical nature.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, like, how much of this is regression to the mean, basically just, like, essentially what we consider bad luck, right? Like, maybe Bautista had some called strikes against him that were not probable called strikes, or he took some pitches that should have been called balls, that changed some counts, and therefore he had to chase. Maybe he just happened to run up against a string of good pitchers. Maybe he just had to run up against a string of umpires with larger-than-average strike zones. You could come up with kind of theories, especially in a month's time, where, you know, this had nothing to do with Bautista. This was just variables outside of his control causing his strikeout rate to go up. And really, the difference between 20% and 30% over, 100 bats is 10 strikeouts, right? So, like, not necessarily we're going to say, there's a huge sample that, defines what Jose Bautista was doing wrong that he's fixed. But it is also possible to just fall into this progression of the mean trap and say, well, of course he was going to get better, but perhaps Bautista was doing something physically wrong. Maybe there was a hitch in his swing. Maybe he was swinging at bad pitches. Maybe he was doing something that he then had to adjust for. And so when we say regression of the mean, I think sometimes we're using that as code for really talented player figures out what he was doing wrong and fixes it.
Oh, okay, that's an interesting way to... we've heard so many... The last year plus has been defined to some degree in part by adjustments from hitters, right? And many of those hitters are hitting the ball in the air more often, right?
Yeah.
What it strikes me as, especially for those writers who have focused on sabermetrics, what we might call loosely sabermetrics, quantitative analysis... A lot of it has been about attempting to separate what's real, what's predictive from, what's merely a product of the process. And this look at swing planes, et cetera, has been the first real time when, especially the tools, like StatCast, for example, has allowed for us to really examine. And of course, the pitching numbers, the pitch effects data has done this to some degree too. But for hitters, this has really allowed us to look at process like these, the way that the physical mechanics of a player's, in this case, swing, really inform his production. What perhaps that reveals is, Socrates says, the more you know, the more you know you don't know. Perhaps learning about these adjustments that are made on a grander scale, what we might learn from that, and I'm interested in your input, especially in the context of someone like Jose Bautista, is how many adjustments we don't actually have any sort of access to.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's probably so many things that happen off the field, workouts between games, whether it's watching video, whether it's, taking BP, things that hitters or players in general do that cause swings and performances that we don't see, right? We don't have any data on that. No one tells us. The players aren't like, hey, here's what I did today. So this is hidden from our view, and we can only kind of get at it from interpreting the results. So we see, like, a player who's just goes, like, crazy, stops striking out. We think, like, maybe he's changed his swing. But maybe it's not that. Maybe it's that he's just chosen to swing at different levels of pitches. And so there's a lot about baseball where I think our understanding has grown significantly in the last 10 years, but there's so much that we still don't know.
I wanted to ask you one thing. It sort of superficially involves Jose Bautista, but it maybe more readily involves Blue Jays manager John Gibbons. Last Tuesday, so a week before today, the Blue Jays were playing at Milwaukee, so of course without a DH. Although that does not necessarily truly explain why this occurred. The team, Gibbons decided to put in the outfield, to play an outfield of Chris Coughlin in left field, Kevin Pillar in center, and Ezekiel Carrera in right. What's strange is he played Jose Bautista at third base.
Yeah.
This is the only start of the season that Jose Bautista's made third base, one of the rare starts he's made there, in the last half decade or so. Do you have any insight into why he might have chosen to do this, especially since Coughlin has actually played a bunch of third base already this season?
Chris Coughlin is terrible defensively.
Yeah.
That's basically what it comes down to. He also played Russell Martin at third base two or three times last week. They really kind of like mixed and matched because Russell Martin's their starting catcher.
Yeah, that's also true. And they did, and they played Russell Martin at third base instead of Chris Coughlin as well.
Yeah. This is basically like John Gibbons saying, Chris Coughlin, I'm hiding you.
Oh, man. Yeah. Well, okay. All right. Sorry about that, Chris Coughlin. Hey, now, I did mention I was going to say something about Roddy Tolese. And this is Dave Cameron. Frequently, this is the portion of the show where I call attention to one prospect in the Blue Jays system. Now, what's interesting about Tolese is, this is even just a month ago, I think, we were talking about if the Blue Jays were going to make some moves, if they were going to accept the fact that this was not going to be a winning season, what would they do in that particular case? And I think one of the possibilities you mentioned is that they would try to do something, try and move Justin Smoak or release Justin Smoak, because they're not paying him very much, and give Roddy Tolese some playing time, right? Yeah. Because Tolese, despite the fact that he's a first-base prospect and that, you know, that requires a player to hit a lot, Tolese had hit a lot. He was only 21. He was 21 last year. Had some success at Double A. That's very strong. He has not had success this year. He's not hitting for much power as he has. Certainly not as much as he did last year. His contact skills aren't that great or fine, I guess. But overall, it's not an overwhelming profile. Now, what Tolese has done, John Lott of The Athletic reported last week that Tolese has started working with Jays legend Carlos Delgado to find a consistent stroke. Now, regardless of what this will mean for Tolese specifically, I don't think we have any way of knowing what Carlos Delgado's influence will be. But I'm curious from your perspective, and if this might shed some light on the possible outcome, what do we know about this sort of like how special trainers work, or especially if like elite or kind of like celebrity hitters get involved with the prospects in the system? Is there any sort of way that that has been measured? Is there any sort of sense of whether like elite ball players are better or worse trainers or coaches than their less talented counterparts?
Yeah, I mean, I think the general consensus in baseball is that actually the less talented players are the ones who actually have some insights, because the ones who have significant physical skills didn't necessarily need to perfect their mechanics or, you know, kind of perfect their swing in order to have success. They just had crazy bat speed and, like, physical gifts that other people didn't have. And I think this is one of the reasons why, like, so many managers and coaches are Brad Ausmus or John Gibbons, right? Like, these guys who, you know, played baseball but not, you know, they're not Hall of Famers. There's very few, I think, what, like, two or three Hall of Fame players ever have been, like, successful Major League managers. And so I think what we see generally is, like, the guys who are extremely successful ball players, either they don't have the desire to, like, have a secondary career because they made a lot of money and, like, now just want to go retire and do something else with their life, or there's something about being that level of excellent that means that you didn't have to learn the same lessons along the way as if you're, you know, Mike Scioscia.
Now, Mark McGwire become a coach in the major leagues.
He's still a hitting coach, yeah.
Right, he's still a hitting coach. and that's interesting because he did have a very successful career, but it was also a little bit disgraced, I suppose, maybe towards the end.
I wonder if like part of him coming back was to try and rehab his reputation.
Well, because I was going to say the same thing. Of course, Barry Bonds passed last year with the Miami Marlins.
Yeah, that didn't go very well.
Well, I think it did go well. I guess the team did not particularly care for him.
Well, he was considered, like, he was let go, and there was reports that the players didn't really respond very well to him, and it'll be a while before he gets a
very positive experience.
Yeah, no, it didn't. It was not a success.
Well, I know that the sort of historic example is of Ted Williams' run as the Washington Senators coach, where he basically was like, why don't you just be the best player?
And do this. Do what I did.
Yeah. That's not a very helpful pedagogical situation. Now, Dave Cameron, let us use some time. I don't know if that closes the book on Roddy Tolese, but I thought it was an interesting note and might be worth monitoring to see if there really has been adjustment and, you know, what that entails. This is the part of the show, Dave Cameron, when we look ahead at the week. Now, part of the week has already occurred because we typically go Monday through Sunday. As I say, we were recording this on a Tuesday. So the Monday has occurred. And on that Monday, the Toronto Blue Jays scored nearly enough runs for an entire week, beating the Cincinnati Reds 17-2. Which actually, now the Reds entered the year without much in the way of pitching, but their offense has been fantastic. I think they have the highest collective position player WAR overall. So I suppose at some level you'd have to consider that a satisfying victory.
Sure. Anytime you win 17-2, you're probably like, yeah, that was a good game.
you think that's a sufficient...
I would imagine John Gibbons did not dress the guys down after the game.
Do you think he dressed them up?
Maybe. Maybe they went out for a night in the town in their tuxes.
Okay. So let's look at the week ahead. We have two more games here versus Cincinnati. I can inform you that according to the Fangraphs game probabilities, it's sort of generic probabilities based on the pitcher's pitching and the probable lineups. We have winning percentages, both right around 60%. And then we have the Yankees will be coming to town. And generally speaking, probably in no small part due to the home field advantage, the Blue Jays are expected to win. They have better than 50% odds in almost all those games. tonight, actually... and this pop will probably be up in time. They're facing Asher Wojciechowski.
Wojciechowski,
who has made a couple of relief appearances, but has really has not made any starting appearances this season. Only has three to his credit the whole season. So this seems to be a good thing. Although, question: when a team is facing a pitcher with relatively little in the way of major league experience. Does the pitcher have a slight advantage because the scouting reports may not be out there on him?
Yeah, that's changed a little bit now, where teams are have TrackMan data in the minor leagues and they have PitchFX data in the minor leagues. So the teams aren't working off nothing. They're going to still be able to look at what guys have done in prior minor league years, and velocity is basically the same between the minors and the majors. You're not going to throw 91 in AAA and come up and throw 98 in the majors generally. So I think the change is mostly in video. Like, they're not going to have as good a video to watch, but in terms of like what they expect him to throw, they're going to know what pitches he throws. They're going to know roughly how hard they are, what's kind of his go-to out pitch. I think that advantage has diminished in this age of technology.
Now, we have spoken at points both in this program and Fangraphs audio, where we also talk. I think because recently the Blue Jays played the Mariners, and there was a bit of a question mark as to who they would even be facing. The Reds seem to be suffering maybe from a similar problem, right? Because, as I say, Wojciechowski today, it was Lizaverto Bonilla tomorrow, Tim Adelman, or it was yesterday, and Tim Adelman will be on the 31st of May. This is not, these are not brand name pitchers. What's going on with the Reds and their pitching staff at this point?
It's bad.
Okay. All right. Very good. Insightful analysis from Dave Cameron. The Yankees, however, they have some better names, some more recognizable names in their staff. And in particular, it appears as though the Blue Jays will be facing two of the rotation's more talented pitchers in Michael Pinedo and Luis Severino. Last year, they were both among the best pitchers in terms of strikeouts and walks, but allowed a lot of hits and home runs. Where are they so far as that goes this year?
Yeah, both have improved. They're both interesting in their fastball slider guys who have changeups but have not historically done well when throwing that changeup, so they've been weak against left-handed pitching or left-handed hitting. I think Severino specifically, his changeup has improved significantly this year. There's the dog. So some of his steps have been, step forward has been improvement against left-handed hitters. The Blue Jays don't have that many left-handed hitters, so that might not be a huge deal. But the fact that they have a lot of, right-handed power in their lineup suggests that Severino and Pineda are probably not great matchups for this team.
Right. It should be noted that the last time, the Blue Jays faced Severino, they did face him once earlier this year. They actually were did manage to avoid the strikeout. So perhaps they'll do that again. They struck out only three times in 5 2/3 innings. So perhaps they know something that maybe other hitters in the league have not been able to identify. But we could stop there. I think that's a bit of a look at the head. Look ahead at the week. I guess what generally speaking, the Yankees have been playing much better than one could expect, right? One would have expected entering the season. What's been behind that? If not beyond, I suppose, Michael Pineda and Severino.
Well, Aaron Judge, who was considered a questionable starting outfielder on their team in spring training, there was some thought like maybe he would go to AAA and they would start Aaron Hicks instead. Aaron Judge has been, I don't know, the third or fourth best hitter in baseball to this point, leads the majors in home runs. He's been a monster, so that's changed their offense. Matt Holliday has been very good. Aaron Hicks, as mentioned, has played extremely well. Starlin Castro is having the best season of his career to this point. So a bunch of their younger hitters and then Matt Holliday have probably outperformed expectations.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Dave Cameron, for participating in the Pitch Talk Blue Jays podcast.
You're welcome.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll let you go. But what I will say in the meantime is that has been Dave Cameron. He's the managing editor of Fangraphs.com. I'm Carson Cistulli, and this has been the Pitch Talks Blue Jays podcast.